Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Welcome to the Modern Homesteading Podcast.
We have allowed ourselves to become so disconnected and ignorant about something that is as intimate as the food that we eat.
Be prepared to grow your own for victory.
God said, I need somebody strong enough to clear trees and heave bales, yet gentle enough to yean lambs and wean pigs and tend the pink foamed pullets who will stop his mower for an hour to splint the broken leg of a meadowlark. So God made a farmer.
Hello and welcome to the Modern Homesteading Podcast. I'm your host, Harold Thornbrough, and glad you're back with me again this week. And today is the Wormcast. It's all about vermicomposting. In this episode, I'm going to discuss composting with worms. I think it's a fantastic way to compost. It'll provide some valuable nutrients for your garden. And I'm going to tell you what you need to know to get started with your very own composting system. So before we jump into that, let's look into our homestead updates for this week. What's been going on around here at the small town homestead? Well, we've been treating rabbits for ear mites. It's funny how in the middle of winter, your rabbits get ear mites. And I had this same problem last year. And there's a couple different ways we've treated in the past. You can do it the completely natural way. You can use like an oil, like an olive oil, and that works. But you have to go out there and you have to stay on top of it. You have to do it. I found I had to do it several times, maybe 10, 12 times before I got rid of the ear mites using the olive oil. It is effective. You just put on some rubber gloves, get your rabbit, and you kind of rub that into their ear and a few drops of it in their ear and rub it in and keep that moist with that olive oil, and it kills the ear mites. But then you got to stay on top of it because those eggs are going to hatch. Any eggs that are in there will hatch because it won't kill those. And then you got to kill those that hatch so before they breed again. And it's just kind of a messy, ugly little thing you got to deal with when you have rabbits. But they're not real hard to get rid of, but they do cause your rabbits some discomfort if you don't take care of that. But this year, last year, I ended up going with because I got them a couple times. Second time, I went with a commercial medicine for ear mites that I bought at a TSC, and I found just a couple treatments of that, and it worked real well. So we went with that this year again, and seems to get rid of them pretty quick. But it's not real difficult. It's just kind of nasty. Like I said, you put on some rubber gloves and rub it into their ear, and it's all crusty and nasty. It's kind of gross. But, you know, hey, that's homesteading, right? We do a lot of things that are gross, no doubt about that. But it's just things that have to be done. It's also been kind of decision time for me on whether to get a different truck or fix my old one. Tough decisions on a homestead. You know, you want to be frugal. You want to get all the use you can out of something. But there comes a point, especially with vehicles, where it can cost you more to keep an old vehicle, to keep fixing it and you know, taking care of it, than just getting something a little bit newer. It's in better shape. I've got a truck, a 91 Chevy truck, a full-size truck. And it's rough. It's got about 300,000 miles on it. It's never had a rebuilt engine, which the engine still runs pretty good, but everything else is going out on this truck. I mean, with those kind of miles, you're going to have some engine trouble at some point. The front ends need a lot of work. I'm going to have to really tear into it and spend a little bit of money on it. Or, you know, I can just maybe, you know, throw in the towel and say, it's time to get another vehicle. And I've been kind of just tossing that around. Me and my wife's been talking a lot about that. So is it time to get another truck, or is it time to fix the old one up a little bit better, put a little more money into it? Yeah, we're weighing that out. I haven't really decided yet, but you know, those are the kind of decisions you got to make on a homestead. Well, just any family has to make for any kind of frugal living. What's going to be the best thing to do? I kind of like the idea of getting a newer truck. That one's pretty rough, but I'd never get a new truck. For several reasons. One, I just wouldn't pay that much. But even used trucks are really expensive. It's kind of surprising to me how expensive trucks are. And I need a truck. But I would never want one that's really too nice, because I'm kind of rough on trucks in the sense I bash up the beds pretty good. I mean, I'm always denting something or scratching something. So I try to be careful, but you know, you're tossing some wood into a over the bedsides and you hit the side one day with something and you know how it is. And you don't want to do that to a nice truck. So every truck I buy has always got a few dings and dents in it. Anyway, nothing real bad, but you know, I'm a little rough on my trucks. I do a lot of hauling, so I always take that into consideration. The big news around here, though, is last week we officially launched the Homestead Forum membership community. If you don't know what that is, it's the I've talked a little bit about it the last couple weeks, and I actually launched it a couple days early than what I'd said I was going to launch it, and a few people jumped in. Really happy to see that. But room for a lot more, trust me. We don't have near the numbers that we'd like to have in that, but we're just starting. The Homestead Forum membership community is there to support this podcast. We're not just asking you to support the podcast. We're wanting to give you something in return. I'm just, you know, I've always felt funny about in the past. I've always asked for just donations or was thankful for those who donated through PayPal. And we even did the Patreon thing for a while, and I really didn't give much value there. And some people were giving through Patreon, and I thought, you know, I don't want to do that. I want people to give to this podcast for sure, but I want to give plenty in return. I want you to get your money's worth, if you're going to support this podcast. So what I did is I set up a membership, and for $29 a year or $2.99 a month, very affordable, but you're going to get a lot for that. There's all kinds of things we're doing with that. And for one, you're going to get an extra podcast every week in the Homestead Forum. You go there, you can listen to it. It's for members only. And, you know, I've already got a couple loaded up in there. We just launched this last week. I started off with a couple in there right off the bat. And those are going to be great to listen to, and you're the only ones that's going to hear them if you're part of that membership. Also, there's videos in there. Now, videos won't be going up every week. There's probably going to be a lot more of them done in the spring and the summer than what are there now. There's a few videos in there now, but we want to keep a good stock of videos going up in there that you can go in and enjoy. These will be members-only videos. They're going to be training. They're going to be homestead tours, things that we're doing around here, you know, a lot of that kind of stuff. Hopefully, I've talked to some other people about getting some videos, doing some videos from their homesteads for the membership community, and they're interested in that. So hopefully we'll have some videos coming in from other people as well that we can load up in there, but just a few videos you can watch as well. Also, there's some PDF downloads in there that I've put together, and other people are going to be putting together and bringing in as well. I have put together a list of free public domain ebooks that you can actually find anywhere on the internet, but I've kind of compiled them and put them in there for you to find easily. Also, every week I'm going to do a live discussion chat, or I'll be on video and there's a chat room and you can ask questions. We're going to talk about a topic or whatever, and just have some community time, you know, get to know one another, and you'll have some personal access to me where we can talk about some homesteading topics. I think that'll be a lot of fun. I already put the first one of those up yesterday, so I enjoyed doing that. But I think one of the greatest things about this community is the discounts. We have a few folks with products for homesteaders who have donated discounts for their products. Right off the bat, we had a 30% discount from Powakawaka Valley on their ebook for Artisan Bread. You get 30% off on that. And you also get 30% off on their one-year e-course called The Productive Gardener. It's a gardening course in self-sufficient gardening. And she says, get a full-time harvest from a part-time garden. So I think that'd be a great course, and get 30% off for that. Also, if you need some comfrey for your homestead, which I think every homesteader needs to have comfrey for their homestead, you need to be growing that. It has so many benefits. I did a podcast on that. Go look it up. Listen to it. You're going to want some comfrey. Well, Marsh Creek Farmstead has a 20% discount for our members for all their comfrey products, for their comfrey cuttings and their crowns. So check that out if you're a member. Also, Melissa K. Norris has graciously offered a 40% discount for her handmade masterclass. And that's where you learn how to make soap, herbal oil, herbal infused creams and balms and candle making. And Also, her Home Canning with Confidence course, she's offering 50% off with that for our members. So some great things there. Also, we have another ebook offered from Purposely Simple, Raising Chickens Naturally. I think that'd be a really good book, 50% off on that from them. So a great ebook there. So some great discounts for members. Those discounts alone are worth way more than what the membership would cost you. So if you're going to consider purchasing any of those things right there, it's worth being a member. But you're getting so much. Like I said, you're going to have the back catalog of those podcasts, videos, live discussions, just so much going on in there. Plus, you get to support this podcast, and we can make this podcast better and upgrade some equipment and be more consistent on what we're doing with our podcast and all the other work we're doing. So hope you'll consider being a part of that membership and supporting the work of this podcast. So that's all I'll say about that today, but thank you for considering that. Homestead relevant news this week. Now, I ran across an old article. This article is back from 2013, but I'd never read it before. And it was a UN report, and it says that small-scale organic farming was the only way to feed the world. And like I said, it's an old article. It's not the article, I think, that's so great about this. What I thought was great in this article was there's a link. There's a link to a 300-page PDF that's really worth reading. I agree mostly with the things in this article, in this PDF. Not everything. There was some things in there. I was like, that's questionable. But I loved where they were going with it. The article is titled "Wake Up Before It's Too Late," and I put a link to the article in the show notes. By the way, you can find these show notes at smalltownhomestead.com/75. But yeah, check out the article and then go to that link for that PDF. Like I said, it's a 300-page PDF, but it's a really good read. I kind of skimmed through it. I didn't read it in detail, but really good stuff about organic gardening and what the organic a way to farm in a small-scale way. That would be better for the planet in so many ways. And really, what I read in it was a lot of permaculture principles. So I think it's worth reading, checking out, at least downloading on your iPad or whatever, and check it out when you have a chance. But yeah, look at that article. I'll have a link to it in the show notes. This week, on our Hanging Out in the Homestead Front Porch segment, I asked a question in the front porch for the podcast. And the question I asked is, what is one thing homesteading has brought into your life that you couldn't imagine living without now? And had some great responses to that. I'll read a few of them, but you should go check out the link. And if you're not a member of the Homestead Front Porch Facebook group, that's our Facebook group for this podcast. Go and request to join. That's all you have to do. And there's a couple questions I ask. Answer yes to those. We'll get you right in there. But this week's question had some great answers. Right off the bat, something that homesteading brought into the lives of folks that they couldn't imagine living without. Right off the bat, we had health. Folks said farm fresh eggs, just some of the benefits of homesteading, peace of mind, meat that I know where it came from, love of the soil. This person said it has opened my eyes to the weirdness of our country in this time. Yeah, it goes on to say some more things. Good food, freedom, simplicity. Going back to our roots. And a lot of folks mentioned certain animals like lambs, chickens, just their livestock, pigs. I mean, had a lot of that, goats. Some people had a really hard time narrowing it down to one thing, and that's, I understand sense of pride. And then some people come up with some funny things like mason jars, freedom and a real, sense of responsibility. Yes, there's that. There's a lot of things here. Homemade bread, slice of freedom, contentment, self-sufficiency, a lot of peace, a lot of things that they would miss from their garden, peppers, tomatoes, things like that. So there's a lot of things there. I mean, you go and read the article, heating with a wood stove or some good stuff, but I don't want to read through them all. I'm just kind of skimming through them. This person said cast iron pans. Yes, you'd hate to have that out of your life. And just their, just their appreciation for their vegetable garden and their animals. So really good stuff there that would make you, if you're not a homesteader and you're considering homesteading, sign up into the, join the Homestead Front Porch Facebook group and read this post. I'll have a link to it in the show notes. It's really worth looking at because it really make you consider some of the reasons and some of the things people would say, I would hate to ever give this up in my life. So worth a read. It's very encouraging. I thought it was interesting. And that was a good question for the front porch this week. And I usually ask those questions, so it's a fun way to partake in the podcast. So if you want to join that group and be part of that, that'd be great. On to our main topic of discussion today. I wanted to talk about vermicomposting. Now, this topic came from some folks. I was actually intending on doing this podcast probably in the spring or maybe late in the summer next year or later this year. But there were some folks in there that requested it in the front porch. And you can do that. You know, I'm open to any suggestions. I'll talk about whatever people want to hear about. I mean, that's why I do this podcast. I don't want to talk about things you don't want to hear about. So if you have a suggestion for podcasts, throw it at me. I may not get to it right away, but I definitely put it in a list of possible podcast episodes, and then I'll do them if I get a chance. But I thought vermicompost, why I was wanting to wait a little while on the vermicomposting, I've been vermicomposting for a while. But last year, I actually kind of built a test system, actually two different setups on composting my rabbit manure. So I was going to wait and talk about that a little bit more detail. I think I've seen enough to understand what I'm seeing, but I'll probably get back to you further on that in the summer. Through the winter, it's a little slower process. I'm composting the rabbit manure outside. We'll talk a little bit about that later. But yeah, I've been composting in the house with vermicomposting for a while. So I'll tell you a little bit about that. We'll talk about my setup outside a little bit. But why do vermicomposting in the first place? Is it better than composting outside? And the answer is it's different, you know, and in some ways it is better. So why do vermicomposting? Well, you're putting your food waste and your trash to good use. You can do that with a regular system as well, but it's just another way to put more of it to use. One of the big reasons I do it is I'm able to compost in the wintertime. It's very hard to do a compost bin outside in the wintertime. It's not going to break down near as quickly. So you're not going to get that great composting in the wintertime. You will get some breakdown. It will generate some heat, but not like it will in the summertime for sure. But I'm able to produce a little bit of compost in the winter, and it's a better compost, I think. It creates a valuable, third reason is it creates a valuable product. And what I like to use that product for, the product being worm castings, which is worm waste, it creates this valuable product, and it's great for seed starting for one thing. I do like a 50-50 mix with it and put it in with my compost from the garden or from outdoor regular compost. I'll take a regular compost from outside and go about 50% worm castings, about 50% that, and it makes a fantastic seed starter. And I also take a lot and put in the garden. I just sprinkle it around in the pots, especially if I'm growing anything in containers. It's really good in that handful of that here and there. Mix it into the dirt. I'll smear a little bit around the garden here and there. It's just a great addition to your garden. I don't produce a ton of it. I will be. I'm assuming that I will be producing a lot of it with the rabbit manure setup that I have now. But with my home composting, my indoor composting bins, I don't produce as much as I'd like to have. So I'm kind of sensitive on where I put it. I kind of sparingly put it around things. That's some of the reasons you would want to do vermicomposting. It's just a great way to compost, gives you a real valuable byproduct, and get rid of those household waste, and you don't have to throw it in the trash. We'll talk a little bit more about what you would put in a vermicomposting bin in a minute, but how do you build a worm bin? Well, there's a few different ways. You'll find a bunch of different ways, especially if you go on YouTube and look around and search vermicomposting bins. A lot of people are doing it a lot of different ways. The best and simplest ways, I mean, you can take one bin and create a vermicomposting bin, but it's not going to be the best thing to work with. It's going to be harder to harvest. It's going to be harder to maintain moisture. The best thing to do is to start with, if you want a very simple setup, is you can get a couple of the 10-gallon Rubbermaid bins. And what you'll do is you'll need one lid and two bins. You'll set the one bin inside the other, so it's going to leave a gap. The handles are going to come down. It's going to leave, or you can set a couple bricks in the bottom to kind of leave a gap, because you're going to want that other one 2-3 inches up off the floor of the other one. It'll set down in there so far. Usually the handles will keep it a couple inches off the bottom of the other one, but if they don't, you can set something in there to raise it up a little bit. But you do that, and I'm just going to kind of simply go over. You can find these directions on YouTube real easy by searching vermicomposting bins, but it's the simplest setup. And it's an easy one. It's not the easiest for harvesting castings, though, and I'll talk a little bit about that in a minute. If you want to set up this, just get your worms going, get you some, you know, get some vermicomposting happening. This is the simplest, cheapest way to do it. Couple Rubbermaid bins, one will set in the other. Around the top, though, where you have that gap where it sticks up on the second one, the one on top, there's a gap. You'll want to drill some holes around that, probably about 3/4 inch holes. Now, what I did when I first, the first ones I built were this style. You'll want to take some screen, like some screen, window screening, and cut out some little squares and glue that over those holes because your worms can crawl out of those. So you'll want to cover those up with some screen, with hot glue gun or some super glue or something, and kind of cover those up with that screen and put your lid on. But the reason you'll do this is because you're going to drill a whole bunch of holes, little holes, like 1/4 inch holes in the bottom of this, the top bin, and that's to catch the liquid into the bottom bin. There's a leaching, a worm waste that comes out, and you'll want to separate that to maintain a proper moisture in your worm bin. That's why I say if you're using just one bin, it's a lot harder to maintain that moisture because it's going to stay a little too moist for the worms. And they're going to try to escape. They're going to try to come up out of the top. But if you can keep it, you want to keep your soil, and we'll talk about that in a minute too. You want to keep it somewhat damp, but not real moist. And they'll maintain that. Your food scraps will actually maintain a lot of that moisture, but you want a lot of that, that waste, that liquid waste to pour out into the bottom one, into the bottom bin. So you'll have a bunch of holes drilled in that top one, in the bottom and around the top to create an airflow. Now, what you'll begin with, is you'll want to put some, shredded paper. You're going to want to use like a black print newspaper or, some like cardboard. Clean cardboard, like we'll use things like toilet paper and paper towel rolls, things like that. But you'll shred that or tear it up into a bunch of little pieces. And you want to, you know, 2 or 3 inches of that in the bottom just to create a barrier and give them something to start eating. Get that a little bit wet. Just kind of sprinkle it with some water, spray it, mist it, use like a mister and just kind of mist it and just get it very, just a little damp. And then you'll want to get some food scraps going in there. So what we like to use, well, you know, I won't get into that right now. I'm just going to tell you, you'll want to throw a little bit of your food scraps in there. And I would actually let those break down for a few days before I add any worms, probably like a week. So you're going to want all this kind of break down, keep it a little bit moist, spray it, keep it moist for about a week. And then I'm going to add, in a system this size, I'm probably going to add a couple dozen worms right off the bat. And we'll talk in a minute about the kind of worms you're going to want. But I would add a couple dozen worms, and then you're going to add a little bit more food scraps. And then you're going to cover that with some more shredded paper. So you want to create a layer where they can get down in there and work, and they're out of any kind of light. They're going to want to be under that. And it's going to help to maintain the moisture in there too. And you don't have to wet that down. You can just kind of sprinkle that over the top. And everything underneath that's going to be moist. So that'll kind of keep things going. That'll get you started. And then each week you'll add some more food and then a little bit more on the top. So we'll talk about all that in a moment, but that's the simple design. I think a better, more complex design is called a flow through vermicomposting bin. And this is what I ended up going with in my house. Okay. Cause these simple ones were working good for a couple years, but what makes them not so great is when it comes time to harvest the castings. So you might want to build what's called a flow-through vermicomposting bin, and you can look those up on YouTube as well. And it's a little more complex to build, but once you build it, you're going to be very happy because it's going to be way easier to harvest those castings. And again, you're going to have it's a two-bin setup, but you're going to basically cut the bottom out of the other bin completely. You're going to put some, the second bin is you're going to cut a side out of it. One of the sides, you're going to cut a square out of the side that you can get in there and get castings. And then at the top of that bottom bin, you're going to drill some holes, and you're going to run PVC pipe through those holes. So it every few inches. So basically the top bin will set on top of that PVC pipe, and you'll have these pipes going across. And you'll be able to go up between those pipes to get to the top bin, to get to the castings on the bottom. Now, what you'll do when you set that on there is you'll layer that with maybe a 1/2 inch of cardboard, because it's going to take a while for that to decompose and break down. And by that time, your worm castings are going to be compacted in there, so they're going to stay up there after that goes away. Because that'll, like I said, it'll get moist, the worms will start eating it, and it'll take a while. But once they do, you'll have a compacted layer of worm castings, and then you'll be able to reach that from the bottom bin. Now, maybe if I'm not describing this real well in a podcast, this is something you really almost have to see. So go on YouTube and find some designs like this. You can even build this out of a trash can or something like that, and it works real well. But you can use these bins for that as well. Matter of fact, your top bin can actually be a larger bin, like a 20-gallon Rubbermaid, because they're a lot taller, and that we can get a lot more in there, and use the 10-gallon for the bottom one that you're going to use. But it'll be a really solid setup, and once that decomposes, that cardboard between those pieces of PVC pipe, you can reach up there and you can rake. You can use your hand or you can use a tool. I actually have like a spaghetti spoon. I don't know if you've seen those, like when you're making spaghetti and it's that spoon that's got like the forks that stick up off the top of the spoon. And you can use that and kind of rake it, and your castings will fall down into that bottom, and then you can just kind of scoop them out and take them wherever you want. And this is a really good way to consistently harvest your castings without having to dump the bin and completely go through them and then screen them and all that. We'll talk about that in a few minutes too, but it just makes a way better setup. And like I said, it's hard to describe that setup in a podcast. It's something you almost have to see. So find that on YouTube and make you one like that. But if you're just looking to get started quick and you just want to get something going, you're only going to harvest these castings in another setup 2 or 3 times a year, probably. So it's not something you're going to have to deal with right away. So if you want to get started with the other system, it's quick, it's easy, it's going to get you going. There are commercial worm bins you can purchase. The Urban Worm Bag is one I've seen. There's one called Can of Worms, Can of O-Worms, I think. A Worm Wigwam. The one I see the most is called the Worm Factory 360, and that's kind of like a rotating system. That's really good. A lot of people use that one. It's not super expensive, and I've seen that one in working before, and it actually looks like a really good setup, and people have that right in their kitchen. I mean, you can set something like that up in your kitchen. It looks nice, and you'll never even know. People won't even know it's a worm bin, and you can throw your scraps right in there. But those are just some simple commercial worm bin setups, but you're going to spend more money than what you're going to spend building one yourself, and they're really simple to build. So I would suggest building one. Let's talk about what to compost. What are you going to feed your worms? Because it's real important. You can definitely mess up your system by doing this wrong. You want to try to feed your worms an equal portion of greens and browns, and we'll talk about what that is. Greens would be vegetable and fruit scraps, bread, pastas, coffee grounds. You can even toss like the filters in if you're making coffee with a coffee filter, tea bags, dead plant matter like leaves and grass clippings, things like that, or from house plants. That you can throw those things in there. Browns would be your shredded paper, shredded junk mail. Like I said, be careful on that. Don't use any glossy papers or colored ink. So be selective on that. Paper egg cartons, just pieces of cardboard, like I said, like toilet paper rolls and paper towel rolls, things like that. Old paper towels, of course. Dry leaves, also, per your brown. Try to avoid salty foods, citrus, spicy foods, oils. I try to personally avoid any kind of prepackaged leftover foods with a lot of preservatives in them. You could throw those in there. They'll eat them, but I try to avoid a lot of that. Meat and dairy byproducts. It's not because they won't eat it. It's because they won't eat it fast enough and it'll start to smell. So I would avoid any kind of meat or dairy products because it will start putting off a stink if they don't eat it fast enough. Because a worm does really good at breaking down food. It'll eat, a couple hundred times its body weight a week, but it's kind of a slow process and stuff in a week. I mean, it's going to start to stink. So be careful about that. And it'll attract flies and things like that if it don't break down quick enough, if it starts to have some smell. So you want to try to maintain that. You want to have a consistent flow on what you're putting in there. We'll talk a minute about why you might want to do that. But let's talk about what kind of worms you want to use. I use what's called red wigglers. And what's really great about wet red wigglers is you can actually find them in your backyard. But if you're wanting to get them quick, you can go and get to a bait shop and where they sell bait for fishing. And you can usually buy red wiggler worms there and get a couple dozen of red wiggler worms and toss them in there. That's going to be your best way to get started. There are a couple other kinds of worms you can use. There's one called the European nightcrawler. Now, you don't want to use the nightcrawlers we have here. Nightcrawlers are... they're more of an earthworm. Okay. They're for dirt. They're not for breaking down compost. You want the red wigglers for that. They're a composting worm. But European earthworms or European nightcrawlers, I guess they're called, they're our composting worm. There's also an African nightcrawler, I think, or earthworm that's for that as well. But what you're going to use around here and where we're at is called a red wiggler. It's going to be real easy to find, and it's going to be the worm you're going to want to use. Now, let's talk about the moisture of your compost bin. This is probably going to be the most important factor. This and temperature are going to be your most important factors on maintaining the vermin composting bin. Your compost needs to be about as moist as a wrung out sponge. Or building a design that will allow liquid to drain out the bottom will be your best way to maintain your moisture. Also, holding to a weekly feeding schedule, not going down there every day or two and throwing food scraps in there, that's going to let your compost get way too moist. What we do is I keep like a coffee can, like a 2-quart coffee, like one of them plastic Folgers coffee cans, and we'll throw some food scraps in that. I have a couple of those, and we'll just throw a few food scraps in there, and I stick it in the freezer. And I'll get it out, pop the lid off of it, throw a few more things in there, stick it back in the freezer. I actually get a couple of those a week because I have two systems. So we can fill up a couple of those pretty easy in a week with our food scraps. But I keep them in the freezer so they don't start, you know, getting rotten or smelling or anything like that. And then I go down once a week and I dump one of those in each one. Now, that's probably even a little bit more. It's usually sometimes a week to 10 days probably. I'll take it down there, dump that in there, and then I throw some paper, some shredded paper over the top of that and kind of give it a good coating over the top of that, about an equal amount over the top of that. And that seems to maintain a really good moisture in my system. So how often you're feeding, how moist the food is you're feeding them, and how good of a drainage system you have on your compost bin is going to help you maintain your moisture. Now, if you start seeing it too dry or too moist, you make adjustments. And the easiest adjustment is going to be in how often you feed and how moist the food is you're giving them. So you might have to add a little bit more brown to the system, and that will help it maintain a more regular moisture. So just that takes a little trial and error. For me, I figured out week to 10 days with that coffee can, plus the dry, plus the amount of worms I got in there, plus the drainage I have. It works out really well. It maintains a good proper moisture. But you'll have to just do some experimenting with that. But the design that I'm talking about, that's pretty much a standard way of doing it, and it'll get you real close to where you want to be. But also, like I said, the other thing that's going to help you maintain this vermicomposting bin is by maintaining a proper temperature. The optimal feeding conditions for your worms that I found is about 60 to 75 degrees Fahrenheit. If you get below 50 or above 85, you're actually going to be at risk of your worms dying. So if you have it in your basement, you're probably going to be just right, because you're going to probably, you know, most basements, I think, or our basement runs probably about 65 to 70 degrees. So it's really perfect temperature for them worms down there. I guess it depends on where you're at and the depth of your basement. If you're going to have one of these sitting outside, do not set it in the sun. Set that thing in the shade. You can have it outside, but it needs to be in a shady spot where the sun's not beating down on it, because you're going to kill your worms. They can't handle anything over 85, and your worms are going to start dying. So you just got to watch that. So it's very important to maintain the proper temperature. Now, let's talk about harvesting the castings, because depending on your design, this can be a real chore. If you build one of them basic bin designs that I was talking about earlier, you're going to have to harvest 2 to 3 times a year. Well, that can be pretty tedious, because it's just going to come out. You're going to basically just turn this thing upside down, dump it out on a tarp, and it's going to come out in a big solid clump. Okay. Now you're going to have to break off some chunks. You're going to have to build like a screen, and you're going to have to screen your castings. And a screen would be like, you're going to make a frame with like some hardware cloth on it, and you're going to like rake the castings in that. So the castings go through and you can dump out the worms and kind of get your worms out of it. And you can kind of break those loose so you can have some usable fine castings to use. It's a chore. It's probably going to take you 4 or 5 hours probably to break that down, get it smooth, get your worms separated, get the bin put back together. It's, like I said, you're not going to do this real often, 2 or 3 times a year, but it's a chore. It's a big job. And that's why I went with what was called that flow bin, because it's just much easier to harvest your castings. Like I said, I can just rake, go up under in the hole through the side, rake the bottom of the top bin, the castings fall down, and then I just scoop them up. And I can do this, you know, once every 2, 3, 4 weeks. I can get however many castings I need. If I'm potting up some things or whatever, I go down and get me a couple handfuls of castings and throw in there, and it works real well. So Harvesting the castings can be a chore depending on your design. Now, I'll tell you a little bit about the design I made outside for my rabbits, for their waste. I actually, in my rabbit area, I have cages down two different sides. And I made this kind of experimental. I have them in cages and they have the hardware cloth bottoms where their waste falls through. So I'm collecting their waste underneath them. And then they're about 4 feet off the ground. So there's a big area underneath of them to collect these. Now I have that area. Both sides are completely tarped in. So the waste doesn't fall out around there. It stays in directly below the cages. So I have these tarps strung really tight and I have it framed in. So it's really tight. Well, I have the fronts of those tarps where I can drop them down. Okay. And I can see what's going on and I can add more, compost to it if I want, or whatever I want to do, or rake it around a little bit. But both of those are vermicomposting setups. Now each side is different. I have a row of cages down one side, a row of cages down the other side, but each side is set up different. I have one side going straight to the ground. And they're not, the worms are in there. They're breaking it down. It's more like that first setup that I talked about, where I would use bins. And so basically the leaching is going straight through to the ground. So it's dry because the ground's kind of soaking up the waste, the liquid. But on top of that, the worms are just doing their work. So it's going to be just a pile of castings, but I can go in there with a shovel and just kind of scoop it up and do whatever. The other side I built more like the flow through design. I actually raised the floor up on that one. And I left about a foot or so underneath the waste, and I actually put a 2x4 square fencing all the way across the bottom of that. And I made like the frame, I raised it up, put the fencing across the bottom of that. And I layered that with cardboard, just like I did the in-house bins, the flow bins, and all that waste has been sitting on that. Of course, the cardboard is decomposing because of the moisture coming through. It's falling down, and I can do the same thing in there. I can go through and just rake the bottom of that and the castings will fall out the bottom. So I think that system's actually going to be the one that's going to work better. And I'll probably end up changing the other side. But the other side's still good. I can still use it for just regular compost. It'll have a mixture of just rabbit manure. Some of it'll be broke down into compost. Some of it'll be worm castings. So it'll be a mixture. And the one on the other side will be basically just pure castings. I'll be raking off just the pure castings and bringing them down to the bottom and using that in my garden. Now, because of how many rabbits I have, that's going to produce a lot more castings for me. And I really haven't had a chance to use any of those castings yet out of that, because I built that setup last summer. And so I was building up the manure and it was processing and doing its thing. Anyway, I threw worms in both sides. So both are working. Again, it's outside, so it's not working as fast because the temperature's a little bit lower. It's a little warmer in that area than it is outside, but still it's a little slower process than it would be in the house in the wintertime. So I'll know more about how well that's working in the summer, this next summer. But I think it's going to work well. I mean, it's processing, it's doing its thing. It's, and just how much I'm going to get out of it, I think, is the real question, and how easy it is to harvest it. So that's what I have set up out there. I also think that there's a lot of potential in setting up a lot of vermicomposting bins in business. If you learn how to build these worm bins, I think there's a market for that. I was actually at a farmer's market in Indianapolis, and there was a guy up there selling worm bins. He had set up these vermicomposting bins. He already had them going. He had some stuff in there. He had worms in there. They were working. All you had to do is take this thing home, and he had directions on how to feed them. Okay, so this guy was selling the actual bins and some worms at the farmer's market. You could sell the compost worms. There's a lot of people on Amazon and places like that that are selling compost worms. So they're starting a business selling compost worms. You can actually sell the worms, like I said, to bait shops. And these worms will multiply. I mean, you get a big enough system, they're going to multiply like crazy. And you could pull worms out and they're going to keep multiplying. And you could sell the worms to bait shops or start your own bait shop even. Another big thing you can do with it, if you have enough setup and you're doing enough worm castings, is that you could sell the worm castings. They're garden gold. People buy worm castings. You can go to the store and buy worm castings. Everybody wants those for their garden because they're the best thing you can put on your garden, okay? Really great for potting soils, really great for seed starting, and really great for your garden. So there's a business just in having some vermicomposting bins. If you have enough waste to feed them, there's enough, and you can grow enough worms. There's a lot of business there. You can do a lot. And I think there's a demand for it. I think a lot more people are getting into it, hence why they have commercial bins now. So there's a lot of people looking for the worms. There's a lot of people looking for the bins. There's a lot of people looking for worm castings. So there can be a small little side business, a little side hustle with doing this. I think it's a good idea. I mean, as homesteaders, we're always looking for something else we can do to bring in a little bit more money to our homestead to help us keep up what we're doing, right? I mean, I know I am. I'm always looking for something. So there you have it. There's the basics on setting up a vermicomposting bin. I know I didn't get into a lot of detail in setting up the Rubbermaid bins because I just feel like I cannot describe that well enough in a podcast for you to really understand it. So I'm really encouraging you just to go to YouTube, punch in vermicomposting bins, and just browse around. You'll see some of the setups I'm talking about. And then you can even type in a flow through the vermicomposting bin and see what I'm talking about there, some setups I'm talking about there. And you're just going to get some ideas of what I can do. You know, you can do that. It's really simple. All you need is a drill, a hot glue gun, a little bit of screen, and that's basically it. It's a couple bins, and you can build your vermicomposting bins. They're really easy to build. But YouTube's going to be your best setup on that to check it out. Like I said, you can do this actually with a couple 5-gallon buckets too. I didn't even mention that. If you want to build a really small system, you can do 2 5-gallon buckets and build that. Instead of using Rubbermaid bins, just do it with 5-gallon buckets and just make a smaller setup. If you have a couple 5-gallon buckets sitting around, I mean, it's just not, you're not gonna have as much. You're not gonna have any worms working in there, maybe a dozen worms, to start in that system, that size, but it would work. And that's the thing. The larger the system, the really it's easier to maintain temperature and moisture because it's not going to be as susceptible to change, a quick change, because there's more mass there. There's more stuff there that it's going to absorb the impact of quick changes. So bigger is better in a lot of ways, but those 10-gallon Rubbermaid bins, good way to go. It's a good way to get started for sure. Check them out on YouTube, and I think you'll find that those will work just fantastic. And I hope you'll get started with some vermicomposting. I really do. How about a recommendation for today? Today's reco. Normally, for a recommendation, what I would do is I would say, go out and watch this video or go check out this YouTube channel or go check out this podcast or this website or something. But today, what I'm going to tell you to do is, or this week, things are a little slow on your homestead. Maybe you're not growing that much stuff right now. Here's what I'm going to tell you to do. I'm going to tell you, go support a local food producer in your area. Even if you have chickens, your chickens probably ain't laying as many eggs this week. Maybe go buy some eggs from another food producer, another farmer, another organic farmer in your area. There are people selling things. There are people selling produce. There are people selling meat. Go buy some organic meat from a local food producer, some grass-fed beef, some local farm-raised pork that's been pasture-raised, some chicken that's been pasture-raised, something. Go support a local food producer, even if you have a lot of your own food, even if it's just the only purchase you make. I would say go out and support one. And a couple reasons why. One, it's going to, of course, help that person out, right? They're going to pick up a sale. But I also think it's going to create an opportunity for you to meet somebody, see their operation, talk to them, make a friend possibly, and tell them about what you're doing. It might even open up a channel for barter, but I wouldn't go there yet, but I would, just get to know a person. It's going to open up a door for you, and it's going to create a friendship probably. And it's just going to open up your eyes to other people doing something similar to what you're doing in your area. So I say go support a local food producer in your area this week. And just like me, it's easy for me just to get focused on my little homestead and what I'm doing and forget that there's people right here in my area doing other really good things. And I want to support them. I want to encourage them. And I'd like to get to know them as well. And I think you should do that too. So that's my recommendation for this week. Again, thank you for those of you who would consider joining our Homestead Forum membership community. It's going to be a huge help to this podcast. Thank you to those who shop through our Amazon affiliate links on our website, smalltownhomestead.com. And as usual, thank you for leaving us iTunes reviews and reviews wherever you listen to this podcast. We're always super encouraged by those. Continue to do that. Always enjoy those. If you want to check out the show notes for this episode, they can be found at smalltownhomestead.com/75. Thanks so much for listening. See you again next week. And until then, happy homesteading and God bless.
Thanks for listening. To see the show notes for this podcast or listen to other podcast episodes, go to smalltownhomestead.com. There you can also read our blog, connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, and Google+, and take advantage of the many resources we make available to help you along in your homesteading journey. Please share this podcast and help us to carry out our mission of helping others to homestead today for a better tomorrow.